just start by describing the what you see as like the narrative of your campaign? What's your big summary of what you're doing here?
Absolutely. So I got into this race in November because after it was down to essentially a one-person race at that point, I looked at the field and thought, Portland really needs a mayor who understands what working families are going through, who is going to be committed to the job for the long run and has the experience of working on the issues that Portlanders care about that I think really would be effective. And I didn't see anybody else in the race who met those criteria, so I decided to step up. And I was actually, it was late one night, I was singing a song that I sing to my son every night called Weather the Storm, and that I sing to him as I put him down. He's almost 6 months old, and it's about sort of being brave, stepping up for your community, helping others. And I thought, how do I sing you this song every night and then not have stepped up when I thought Portland really needed it? So, I mean, I think we're at a real turning point. We have a million new people that are going to be moving here over the next few decades, and who do we want to be as a city? Do we want to be a city that is living up to our ethos of a creative, sustainable city where everybody can afford to live, or are we going to be a city that becomes a playground for the wealthy? And I think that's really in question.
Yeah. What have you seen happening in the last 4 years, 10 years, however long, that has moved us in one direction or another?
So I think we've seen a lot of great things happen in the last 4 years, 10 years. I think Portland has changed a lot. I mean, just even basic things like our commitment on safe routes to school has seen a 36% increase in kids who walk or bike to school just since 2006, right? I mean, that's a major success. I grew up in Portland with the ability to walk to Glencoe Elementary School and Mount Tabor Middle School every day, but not every kid has the ability to do that. I think as a community, we've done a good job of planning for infill, for we've made some major improvements on streets. We've had road diets that have been a success, but there's a lot more to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the key things we can do? Talk about transportation to improve the sort of number of ways people can get around without a car.
Well, so when we look at our transportation challenges, you know, I get this question all the time of, hey, when you're mayor, will I be stuck in rush hour at 2 p.m.? Right. And my answer is yes, probably. Mm-hmm. We have a system that was built for cars that other modes have been shoehorned into, and we've seen a massive lack of investment in our road system. And so what we need to do, both for climate reasons and for livability reasons and for health reasons, is give people more options to be able to get around without cars, because it's not like we're going to build roads and build our way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a number of things that we can do. We've sort of hit this point on the bell curve of people who are adopting commuting by bicycle or getting around by bicycle, where we've got, you know, a lot of the really enthusiastic people and sort of the next tier of people that are into it, but, you know, have the ability to do it. But we have this massive middle of the bell curve of people who are interested and would like to do it, but aren't quite sure it's safe or don't quite know how to get around. And that's that next step. And so I think it's great that we've seen an increase in painted bike lanes and green bike boxes and those sorts of things. I use them when I bike commute, which I do. Mm-hmm. But we need more protected bike lanes. And part of my bike route on the way to work is I bike down Multnomah Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And that's a safe way to get to the next part of the segment. And right. So we need more of those. We need better division between auto traffic and bicycle traffic and pedestrian traffic. We need better sidewalks. And we need those investments in areas of Portland that have been underserved, especially in East Portland.
Right. Yeah, so that little raises the question, right? The Multnomah doesn't do as much good as it could if it weren't connected to a better network in inner Northeast.
Right.
And yet 122nd has a striped bike lane that doesn't do as much good as it could because it's terrifying whenever you hit a car that happens to be parked in the unused parking lane right next to it.
Right.
So the how do you go about prioritizing the eternal question of inside or outside? Do you prioritize for coverage or ridership? Probably most of the payoff in ridership is going to be the central city. Probably most of the payoff in coverage is going to be elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you could have an either or strategy, because obviously you need an increase in the proportion of people that are choosing to get around by bike or by foot. Mm-hmm. But you also need options for people who otherwise don't have another option and are stuck in a car. So I think we need a balance between the two. And so I think on key corridors in Portland that are heavily used, I think we need to look at more protected bike lanes and more investment on those key routes. I think there's also low-cost solutions that we can do. Having more dedicated neighborhood greenways that have traffic diversion built into them so that bicyclists feel safe on neighborhood streets, mm-hmm. is a very low-cost way of increasing ridership in the core. Mm-hmm. And then we can save money for doing the kinds of harder infrastructure development that needs to happen in East County. So I don't think it's a zero sum between having people in East Portland be able to have infrastructure and people in Inner Portland have safer infrastructure. I think we can do both. I think we just have to be smart about it.
Right. So you're saying that, but I mean, obviously, eventually there's a dollar that needs to go one place or the other, right?
Sure.
There's some time you need to make a choice, and you're saying that your sort of strategy for thinking about that is to increase the connectivity for bikes in the central city with neighborhood greenways, with a bigger emphasis on neighborhood greenway and neighborhood greenway quality, I suppose.
That's
and then
right, yeah.
Emphasis on concrete in the southwest and east, I suppose.
I think what we need to do is have a system that works, right, from A to B. And
right.
So right now we have a lot of fragments of systems that work. And I even see it on my bike ride in. So I come in on Multnomah, I take the freeway on-ramp that spits me up on Terwilliger,
mm-hmm.
and then I have this terrible turn that I feel like I'm taking my life into my hands the entire time,
mm-hmm.
Before I get onto Barber, and then I'm safe again once I get sort of back onto my back roads and down to the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge is, how do you make sure that on key corridors you have places connected and that you have safe spots at key choke points?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that we can prioritize throughout the city. We don't have to choose Inner Portland or Outer Portland. And that as we choose East Portland, making sure that whatever improvements we're making there is connected into the broader system.
Right. How do we, right now we don't have any system for weighing that into the rest of the system. So like we did this huge talk about parking permit system, right? That it may or may not result in a new option for neighborhoods, but we have never made any effort to like weigh the benefits of a bike lane against the benefits of an auto parking space. So on 28th, it's a very important network connection, and the city decided that the auto parking spaces were more important, and so we don't have a network connection there of any quality. There's got to be some way to say, like, yes, sometimes auto parking spaces are more important, and this is how we know, or, like, is there some system, or is there some, like, way that we can put something to that question so it's not arbitrary every time?
Yeah, that's where good data, good analysis comes in. So I'm actually an economist by training. I worked for a company called Echo Northwest here in Portland.
Right.
That's the kind of analysis a company like Echo Northwest could do, is to measure what is the value of a parking space, what is the value of a connected bike lane, and measure the ripple effects of that, not just in one point in time, but what does that do to neighborhood businesses, or what does that do to people's ability to have a lower transportation budget so they can afford the higher rents,
mm-hmm.
That are being charged, because affordability is really about a sort of a global budget for a family. We need that kind of rigorous analysis as we do our decision making, and it is happening in some places. I think a great example is on Foster. And I'm very excited for the changes that are coming to Foster, and that I think is a perfect example of what I've been talking about how we have better infrastructure, how we have more connectivity, and how we serve equity needs at the same time that we're serving transportation needs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do that in a way by making Foster safer and more friendly to people on different modes of transportation. We're going to help businesses there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a major, major barrier to business expansion and small businesses on Foster has been the fact that there's 5 lanes of dangerous traffic and people don't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great for small businesses, it's great for people who want to get around, and it's good for the transportation system.
Right, but it is going to slow traffic, probably.
Auto
traffic.
It's not clear that how much it will slow auto traffic. Let me give you an example. So
mm-hmm.
Not only am I an economist, I worked in transportation economics,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm very familiar with travel demand models and those sorts of things. I helped work on the economic analysis of the Alaskan Way Viaduct replacement project in Seattle. And there were six different options of different kinds of tunnels and new viaduct. And then a couple of the options were just get rid of it altogether and just have surface streets with that are multimodal.
Right.
And people screamed and screamed and screamed that if we just did that option, that it would cause massive congestion, huge delays. I-5 would see a bunch of spillover. Well, right. We ran the modeling. And in fact, even during rush peak times, it really only changed the travel time by about 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm. By over how long of a distance?
Over the entire distance of the viaduct,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's not that much time.
Right. And they're talking about like 3 or 4 minutes, I think, on Foster.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So 3 to 4 minutes, I think you can sacrifice 3 or 4 minutes for a streetscape that's going to support local businesses, local jobs, and help people get to work.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the viaduct project.
Yeah.
People often bring up the CRC vote for you.
Uh-huh.
What's if you were forget about the plan that was seems to be dead. What's the if somebody comes to you next year and says we need to come up with a new vision,
mm-hmm.
make a new plan? What's your ideal bridge look like?
Well, one, we have to have public transit light rail
mm-hmm.
Baked into the definition of the project. Two, we have to have strong bicycle and pedestrian facilities on the bridge. But three, and perhaps most importantly, and one of the reasons that I negotiated hard for sideboards on that project
mm-hmm.
and ultimately got to a place where I could support it, was that we need variable tolling
mm-hmm.
that lasts longer than the life of repaying the bonds on the project.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you have the ability to control congestion through tolling on that bridge,
mm-hmm.
then it doesn't matter how many lanes there are because you have a tool right there
right.
to be able to control congestion. Time is money, and people will continue to overuse subsidized free transportation unless you bake the cost of that transportation into it. And
mm-hmm.
congestion pricing and tolling is one very, very efficient way to do that. And so I think a lot of that got lost in the debate because it's a little bit wonky. But if you've got a bridge where you're actually charging people for that cost,
mm-hmm.
Then I think you've got a really responsible transportation strategy.
Right.
And we don't have that on the West Coast right now,
right.
Other than in a couple of places. So the ability to do that in Oregon would be huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there was awareness of that on Clark County side. I think you were Clark County conservatives' nightmare of that saying, we'll build a big bridge, but we'll charge you if to use it, right?
Well, I put those into the project and voted for those sideboards. And ultimately,
right.
it was a lot of those sideboards were the reasons that Clark County
right.
ended up rejecting the bridge in the first place.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not going to waffle. I'm going to stick to my guns.
Sure. So you say it doesn't matter how many lanes? You'd still say that as long as there's variable tolling? It can be an 8-lane bridge. It could be a 10-lane bridge.
The number of lanes is irrelevant if you have sufficient tolling because the demand, what we're talking about is number of cars that are crossing the bridge, right?
Right.
What we're talking about is induced demand. What
mm-hmm.
we're talking about is induced sprawl in Clark County.
Right.
Congestion pricing and tolling solves for all of those things. The number of lanes does not. The
mm-hmm.
number of lanes is not relevant in the conversation.
Right. Except in the cost of the project and therefore the height of the amount of tolling and everything else, I suppose.
Possibly, but if you're using tolling for demand management, then it isn't necessarily related to the cost anyway, because it's not about bond repayment.
Right. Okay. The length of the project, do you have concerns about, like, going back to the freeway funding to build it? Like, how much freeway is it okay to build to get a new, better bridge across the river?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
It seems like a bunch of the critics of the project were saying that you've actually got a little bit of a project as the bridge, and most of the money is being spent on a bunch of new interchanges away from the river.
Mm.
Do you have any criteria for, like, how far away from the bridge makes sense to do any work in this future situation?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I want to get down in the weeds of constructing a hypothetical project right now that currently doesn't exist. So,
right.
But I do think we have to look at responsible use and balance and cost between Oregon and Washington, and that was one of the things that I put into the bill was that we had to have Oregon taxpayers protected.
Okay. Great. The things we're talking about at the in terms of the sort of long-term demand for driving into the central city seems like it's going to depend a lot on the amount of parking we add to the central city. We've been having an argument about whether the PDC should build parking garages at public expense. There's talk about whether the URAs should spend their remaining life to put up multi-million-dollar parking garages in Old Town and East Side. Do you have any thoughts on how that would fit into future economic development for the PDC?
Well, one of the things that I'm supportive of, and I know PBOT has already started looking into, is dynamic pricing on parking. I think there's a real opportunity to have a 21st century solution on pricing parking differently depending on time of day and demand.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, you know, I know you're specifically referring to a article that Bike Portland broke around a potential parking structure in the Lloyd District that's mm-hmm. adjacent to the proposed site for the headquarters hotel.
Well, I'm talking about the future. It seems like that may be a done deal. We're talking about the future mostly, but yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Well, I guess my general thought is I'm skeptical of using public dollars for parking. I'm open to the argument on a case-by-case basis of why it's needed, but I guess my litmus test is going to be, one, does it work for our transportation and climate goals? And two, if it's such a slam dunk, why isn't the private market mm-hmm. doing it? And I think those are questions that haven't fully been answered yet.
But they could be answered theoretically? Like they could be answered in the, you would say, yes, that's a good idea in that case?
Well, I mean, I think there's if there's a reason that the private market isn't investing in it, then maybe it's not a good a deal as we thought it was. So I want to see, I'm very skeptical, I guess is what I would say.
Okay. I can't imagine, personally, I don't imagine any scenario where it's worth building more parking with money that could be used on, you know, improving the street or building affordable housing. But
seems hard for me to imagine, too.
So, like, what is the potential scenario that where you don't want to say no?
You like the hypotheticals, don't you?
Well, I like to get a solid answer, and I feel like it needs to be something like, this is why I'm not saying no to it, right? You're not saying no to it.
So we're talking about one specific case, or are we talking in general about mm-hmm. all cases?
I'm talking about what is the specific case that precludes the general, no, that's a bad idea.
So in the specific case of this parking garage in the Lloyd District, what PDC has said is that the investment is necessary to be able to catalyze the construction of the headquarters hotel, mm-hmm. Which is a major public works project that a lot of people have put a lot of time into. I haven't seen their analysis. I don't know that it is necessary, but they're saying it is necessary to be able to build it and that the project will more than pay for itself over time and it'll be a net benefit to taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true and there really is no other way to do it, then I'm open to the conversation. But I have a hard time understanding why that's true. If it is necessary, why isn't that company just building the parking themselves if it's going to have a return to them?
Right. Okay. Let's talk about affordable housing. What you talked about the various ways to advance that in other forums. I guess the one that we write about the most is specifically about proximity and how do you guarantee that some number of people, if they want to live near their work or their shops or whatever, then how can people reasonably afford to do so? What do you think are the general best strategies for doing that across a broad swath of the population?
Well, I believe in the city strategy around 20-minute neighborhoods. I think there's been a lot of emphasis in Portland on making sure that people are able to live close to where they work, close to where they shop. I think that's an important part of our city planning, important part of our comp plan. And then part of that is about ensuring affordability of those areas. And so making sure that people don't have to get in their cars, don't have to drive, don't have to pay for parking is a big part of that. So when I bike to work, a lot of people say, you know, why do you bike to work? Is it because you care so much about climate change? And I do. I also care about my health. I don't have to spend as much money on a gym membership. But it's also the fastest, cheapest way for me to get to work. And I think the more that we can make it easy for people to be able to do that and not have to incur those costs, the more that we empower people to be able to afford to live closer in.
Mm-hmm. So how does that? How do we accomplish that? What are the city tools that are available to make that possible for more people?
To be able to get to work by bicycle or by walking?
Yeah, to create proximity.
Well, that's a lot of the things that we've been talking about, is making sure that we have safe routes, that we have protected bike lanes, that we have neighborhood greenways, that we have places where people can use alternative transportation, feel safe doing it, mm-hmm. And be able to get to from A to B very quickly and efficiently. When it comes to how do you create interconnected neighborhoods, a lot of that is a function of zoning and planning. I think the comp plan's on the right track, but we need to do more, like bring back duplexes and triplexes and garden home apartments into R5 zoning. Right now, you can't build those in local single-family residential. Those have always been part of the character of the neighborhood, but if we were able to change our zoning to be able to bring those back in, I think it would make a big difference.
Are you talking about in some cases, in all cases? How many, how much of neighborhoods would be able to be, where how many neighborhoods could you legalize that in, do you think, that you'd want to legalize it in?
I don't see any reason why you couldn't have blanket duplexes, triplexes, and garden home apartments in R5 zoning.
R5, yeah. That makes sense. With the Transportation Bureau, is that something you want to run? Do you have anybody else you'd want to run it? What's your thoughts on that bureau?
So the way the city government works, it's a pretty fast path to irrelevance to say, here's the bureaus that I'm going to take, and here's what I'm going to assign my fellow commissioners before you've even sat down and talked to them.
Sure.
In a weak mayor system, it's really the only leverage that you have to be able to assign the bureaus and have the conversation beforehand of, if I assign you this bureau, here's what I'm going to want mm-hmm. from it. And so I'm not going to declare any bureaus other than the mayor should be the police commissioner, and it historically is.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to say out front what bureaus I'm going to assign to folks.
Okay. So either way, you'll be, as mayor, in a substantial role in the funding conversation.
Absolutely.
Let's say the gas tax fails. What's the next step?
Well, first of all, I hope the gas tax doesn't fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that your readers see an opportunity here to help support a transportation system that works for everybody. And I'm in support of it, and I think I'm hopeful that it passes.
Mm-hmm.
If it fails, then you need a mayor who has the connections in Salem and a demonstrated track record of being able to get transportation investments done, who can work with the legislature in 2017 on a transportation package that's going to be multimodal, that's going to have investments for the city of Portland. And I'm the only person in the race that has that track record and has the relationships and the ability to get that done. So I'm going to be right down there in Salem working on trying to get funding for Portland. And part of that, too, is also about having a mayor who has the relationships with ODOT on some of our most dangerous roads. Orphan highways are a huge problem,
mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about 82nd or Lombard or 122nd other places. We need a mayor who's going to work on bringing those back into city jurisdiction with funding so we can do the maintenance on them.
Do you think the orphan highways problem has been jeopardized or slowed down by a lack of relationships? It seems like it's mostly just a money issue, unless there's some like trust issue that's underlying something that I don't know about.
There's certainly a money issue, but the ability to actually engage, negotiate, and get things done, you need somebody who knows the system down there.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying if the gas tax fails, next plan would be to talk to legislators and or ODOT for a chunk of the statewide gas tax, basically, that would be raised or whatever else, other statewide
whatever
funding mechanism.
2017
would be.
Transportation right. package ends up looking like,
right.
yeah.
Are there any other possibilities for local funding, or do you think that transportation funding should continue to come mostly from the state level?
Well, I think if a gas tax fails, it's a pretty clear indication of what people in Portland are willing to support
mm-hmm.
in terms of local funding options. So that's probably the easiest thing
mm-hmm.
to support. So if that fails, then I think we might be stuck. But let's talk about a world in which it passes.
Okay, great.
So if
only lasts 4 years anyway.
If it passes, we have a step forward, but we have a lot more work to do.
Right.
And we have an indication on the books that voters are willing to step up and look at local options. So then I think we need to talk about what are the other things that we need to do. I I am the only person in this race that said pretty consistently that I want carbon taxation and I want congestion pricing. Those aren't always popular, but I think we need to put the full cost of the transportation system on the transportation system and tax pollution and tax congestion in a way that allows us more flexibility to invest that in alternative transportation.
Yeah, how does that work logistically to have a congestion decongestion charge in Portland?
There's a lot of different ways to do it, and there's a lot of cities that have done it. It's everything from hot lanes like Los Angeles uses to potentially cordon pricing to potentially looking at bridge tolling or other things, or something as extensive as variable tolling and on key arteries during peak times. It's not going to happen overnight. You need a mayor who's committed to the long run to changing our transportation system. And I've made a pledge that if I'm elected mayor, I'm not going to run for anything for at least 8 years. So you need somebody who's willing to change the culture, and it's going to be a longer-term conversation. But ultimately, we need an efficient transportation system that includes all the costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Do you think that what's your projected life of the gas tax in Oregon, if you had to guess? How long do you think it takes to shift to a different funding mechanism? Or do you think that we just stick with it? Maybe it works.
So I served on both the transportation and the revenue committees in the legislature, and I probably know, I've probably dealt with this as much as anybody in the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And the gas tax is a declining instrument.
Right.
We could theoretically use it for a lot longer, but it's not keeping up with the cost because, for good reasons, right? We have increased efficiency vehicles. We have CAFE standards that are going to be moving even higher, which makes gas tax less relevant. So I was supportive in the legislature of looking at pay-per-mile kinds of charges that would help better incorporate wear and tear from cars and to be able to keep up with funding for the transportation system. But ultimately, I think we need a constitutional change, and I think we need a mayor who's not afraid to say it. I think that the Highway Trust Fund, and I'm on record saying this for many years, Highway Trust Fund really hamstrings our ability to do smart transportation investment. For those that don't know, the Highway Trust Fund requires every dollar of every tax or fee on the transportation system to go right back into road building. And the fact is it can't fund public transit. And that's one of the reason why public transit is based on user fees and on payroll taxes, and why we have poor, in some places, rubber tire bus service. So we need more flexibility within our transportation dollars to be able to use congestion or carbon or other pricing mechanisms to fund better alternative transportation, including transit, including bike and pedestrian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you? It seems like that's. Let's not even talk about how the amount of conversation that would need to be shifted at the state level to get that sort of referendum passed. Even in Portland, I feel like we're not at a place in the public conversation where it's even safe to say, yes, we need to penalize driving for the sake of everybody.
I'm not saying we need to penalize driving. What I'm saying is that we need
to disincentivize driving.
What I'm saying is that we're not accounting for all the costs.
Okay.
And that when we take those costs of the system, we ought to invest them back in things that reduce those costs. So the ballot measure that I introduced at the state level said very simply, a tax or fee on pollution or congestion in the transportation system can be used to reduce pollution or congestion in the transportation system.
That seems like a winning argument to me. I mean, I guess
seems pretty logical, right? Now, that's if that was the one change that we made, our problems would be fixed in that sense.
Right.
So, I don't think it's a stretch. I just think you need leadership.
Right. I guess it seems to me that there would also be lots of people who would happily frame that in a different way. And so I guess, do you have any sort of notion of like how that conversation gets changed? How do you get people thinking about the benefits of the reduced congestion and pollution rather than the costs of the increased gas tax or whatever?
Well, I think first of all, you need a mayor who's not afraid to talk about it. Second of all, you need a mayor who's not afraid to use a bully pulpit that the mayor has that's probably second only to the governor and the congressional delegation in terms of reach and convening authority. And you need a mayor who's going to get people in the room and say, here's what we need to get done. I mean, we can continue to make little changes around the edges or, pass solutions that only get us part of the way there.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, we have to keep working on those things. But at the end of the day, we need a long-term systemic change.
Mm-hmm.
and saying, oh, it's not possible or the conversation is too hard, I just think that's a cop-out.
Right. What's the biggest area... What's the thing that you most fear that you're wrong about?
In policy, yeah,
what's
or
a,
in life?
In policy, I should say. Yeah, of all the things you'd like to... think should happen for the city, or the city should continue to do, but you might be wrong about something. What's something that you...
Can pause for 1 second.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, I'm just getting over a nasty cold.
All right, we're back from blowing your nose.
Thing I'm most worried about.
What's a belief that you have, a policy belief that you have that might be wrong? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I believe that in our affordability crisis, that we need to increase supply to meet the demand that's coming in, and that in doing so, we can help mitigate the worst of the rise in prices that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely possible that we won't be able to build supply in a way that keeps up with demand, mm-hmm. in a way that brings down costs. And affordability is a crisis in Portland. My wife and I have seen it firsthand. Lots of families are seeing it firsthand. We have to be able to do something about it. So I'm pushing ahead with ideas to help increase the number of units we have available to working families. But if that's wrong, we don't have a lot of time to waste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Talk about the various bureaus. You said the mayor should run the police bureau. What's your take on the balance between sufficient and over-the-top amounts of policing of traffic violations? It seems like there's a lot of folks worried that if you police too much, that it's going to fall on people of color.
Well, that's an interesting argument. I think there's some bias that's inherent in that argument to begin with. But
I think the assumption is that all policing is currently over-delivered on people of color, I suppose.
Yeah. I think that those are two separate issues. I think we need to address the issues of racial and ethnic disparities within policing, broad brush. But I don't think that's... a reason to not do enforcing of the laws that we have on the books, particularly around keeping people safe. I think that there's a real opportunity to have a mayor who's able to work as a partner between the police bureau and PBOT and ODOT and other entities to do safety and enforcement on the streets. And, for example, what happened on Clinton Greenway recently. I think that's helps create a cultural change and a cultural norm around the streets. I mean, we have some of the highest rates of pedestrian fatalities in some areas in Portland. That's not okay. And I'm a big supporter of Vision Zero. I think that's been a great process. And as mayor, I'm going to be absolutely committed to that process. But I think we need to be even stronger. And within Vision Zero, while there's some broad timelines, there's not a lot of check-in points that are baked into the process of, you know, here's how many fatalities we're going to have reduced by this year. Here's the amount of miles of sidewalk or bike lanes that we're going to have upgraded by this year. And we need some real strong teeth within Vision Zero. And part of that is about infrastructure. Part of that's about enforcement, too. And I think that there's a way to have that balance there where we're addressing any disparity concerns, but also making sure that people are safe. Because the fact is when you talk about disparities, it's people who are living in East Portland, which tends to be a much more diverse population, who are getting killed on the sidewalks. I mean, if anything, it's communities of color that have an interest in having safe streets and good enforcement so that people aren't vulnerable.
Right, absolutely, right. But the it seems like there's also, like, there's a clear record of the folks of color who are stopped on bike and by foot are, like, overwhelmingly, disproportionately likely to be stopped, and according to the PPB statistics, and they're less likely to be charged with anything than people who are white, presumably suggesting that it's not clear why they're being stopped at such higher rates. So what is it that the PPB can do to reduce that disparity of, like, where enforcement is happening? Who's feeling like they're being unwelcome in when they're even, you know, showing their face in the open air, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a much larger question than the transportation system.
Yeah,
right?
But it affects transportation.
We have a racial and ethnic disparity throughout the criminal justice system. And in fact, I attend regularly the local public safety coordinating council meetings. I'm working with, sometimes it's called LIPSC. Mm-hmm. I'm working with LIPSC on the racial and ethnic disparity report and how we implement reforms throughout our justice system, not just in the police bureau, but in our jails and in our prosecution and others to eliminate those disparities. We have to have a clear plan, we have to implement it, and we have to do it now. But again, I think that's a separate issue from should we have consistent, clear enforcement of the public safety traffic laws in our neighborhoods. I mean, if you go back to the example on Clinton, I would be interested to see how much of a disparity there was in enforcing speeds and safety on the Clinton bikeway. I don't know what the answer is to that, but my guess is that it was probably a fairly consistent enforcement.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, just the like, one or two-day demonstration, I think that was a special case, and this is a, you know, endemic or something like that, right?
But if we can make it work for 1 or 2 days, can't we make it work system-wide?
Right, yeah, one would think you could. I guess I'm asking what steps could be taken to help it work system-wide.
Well, I think there's, again, the steps on addressing racial and ethnic disparities are a much larger conversation about how we take those steps within the criminal justice system as a whole, with better training, with better staffing in the police bureau that allows for less stress amongst police officers, that allows them to respond to more kinds of calls, and that is implementing the DOJ recommendations. So it's a bigger issue than issuing traffic tickets in neighborhood greenway enforcement, for example.
Right, for sure. So solutions you're suggesting are to increase police staffing levels and make changes throughout the criminal justice system, not just to the police, and to follow the directives from the feds. Is there anything we can do locally beyond that?
Well, I think I also said training and cultural competency.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. My fault.
Yeah.
Great. Is that the full list?
Yeah, and I think there's obviously more things that we can do. I think there's a lot of good folks that are working on this right now through the racial and ethnic disparities data, but I don't think it's a limited problem to the transportation system. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. What's the thing that most recently happened that made you feel enthusiastic about living in Portland? What was it that got you thinking, ah, man, love this town?
I love this city every single day. I mean, I grew up here. I was born and raised here. This is a place where people are incredibly compassionate, where they are really into helping each other out. I have over 100 house parties in my campaign, and I love being in people's neighborhoods and in their living rooms day after day after day, meeting their neighbors and just hearing how invested people are in their community. And there's nothing like walking out of a neighborhood house party after meeting a group of neighbors and finding out how committed they are to everything from scratch kitchens and neighborhood gardens at Abernathy Elementary School to the Portland Mercado, and just what amazing effort that's been, to the whole Living Cully initiative and the effort to integrate more voices into an area that's been underserved. I think that really speaks to who we are as a community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to set any goals for your sort of accomplishments on bikes as mayor? What would your if you wanted to set some numerical goals? I think you mentioned doubling protected bike lanes. That's not a ton of miles.
Well, the question was, would I support doubling bike lanes and protected bike lanes? And I said yes, and then I said actually I think we should do more.
Okay, yeah. How much more? You have a goal?
I think that depends on, again, that balance between infrastructure and equity. But I would support, as mayor, I think we need to have a number of miles of protected bike lanes on key corridors that reflect the usage of those corridors and keeping people safe. I'm not going to say I'm going to have X miles. I think that's a campaign stunt. Mm-hmm. To do that. But I'm going to work very closely with all of our partners in the bicycling community to figure out what's the right number, and I'm going to commit to being mayor that's going to help make that happen.
You mentioned key corridors. You want to float a few that could use better biking?
Well, I think we see them in a lot of places, right? I mean, Barber is a key one, right? Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people commute on Barber, and it's at least feels very unsafe to do that. I think it needs to be integrated into how we're looking at our options on PAL Division and having a better system that's coming in from East Portland. I think there is certainly options that need to happen, even in some of the closer in neighborhoods. I think some of those tend to more fall around greenways than they are around major corridors. But having better separation for the huge percent of people that come in from inner southeast, northeast, and north Portland is really important. I mean, look at the desire for people to take advantage of Sunday parkways. Mm-hmm. Last year, 119,000 people came to Sunday parkways. My wife and I went out and enjoyed it several times. And 119,000 people is an indication of how many people want to be out and about on their streets, on foot, or on bike. Let's unleash that in Portland and make it safe for people to do that.
Great. What was your first bike?
My first bike was a Diamondback dirt bike with coaster brakes on it. Then I rode an REI brand mountain bike for a long time during high school that I rode to school every day on. I was a magnet kid. I grew up in southeast Portland, but I went to Lincoln, and there was no yellow bus service, so I rode my bike to school across the river, across the Hawthorne Bridge every day. And now I have a Jamis commuter that I've just absolutely beat up with all the miles I've put on it, but it's a tank, and I love it.
Cool. Actually, we didn't talk about recreation. Do you have any sort of perceived way forward on getting more single track and other off-road stuff into the city?
Yeah, so I actually, when I was in the legislature, I helped create a out-of-right-of-way urban trails fund and helped get money into it. I think that we need more investment in out-of-right-of-way and recreational biking.
Where is that possible? That's a key.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunities in Forest Park around that, but you know, Powell Butte and some other natural areas, I think there's some real opportunity. I mean, that's where I grew up riding my mountain bike, was in Forest Park and out riding out to Powell Butte and doing that there. And I think there's some fun opportunities to be able to do that. Obviously, we're somewhat constrained within the Portland area, but having an interconnected system where people can get safely to those recreational areas is really important.
Yeah. Is there anything the Parks Bureau can do in general to be more involved in improving biking?
I think it's certainly on their radar screen. I think they're really interested in it. You know, not every park is suitable for recreational biking, but on the ones that are, I think Portland Parks is actually doing a pretty good job and can do more around better signage, better maintenance of the trails, and having an interconnected system.
Yeah, great. That's all I got. I think you're up to how to go. So. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
Yeah.
And don't hesitate to follow up.